January 6, 2007, item number 182. Today's guest is Jeff Pulver from Pulver Media and Network2.tv.
Podcast411.com. Listen different.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Rob, and this is the Podcast 411 Podcast. Before we get into our interview with Jeff, first, some news and notes. As I mentioned previously, I'll be at Social Media 2007 in Atlanta on January 29th. I'm going to be doing the presentation. I'll be arriving at Atlanta on Sunday afternoon, January 28th, and I hope to get together with some of the local podcasters in Atlanta. So if you're in Atlanta, shoot me an email, let me know. And if you are with a company that's interested in getting into social media, you should check out Social Media 2007. There'll be a link in the show notes. As I mentioned on the last show, I now have the Podcast 411 blog going. I just put up a post about how many people are consuming podcasts. And I did this post based on surveys that were done in 2006 from Nielsen, from Arbitron, from Forrester, and from Pew, and threw in some numbers from Libsyn also. So if you're interested in knowing how many people are listening to podcasts based on the different surveys that are out there, check out that blog post. Additionally, there's a couple of posts in there about some podcasts where I was interviewed and did some appearances on in the past week. On New Year's Eve, I was interviewed on the World Bridges podcast. Jeff interviewed myself, Shelley Brisbane, and Scott Fletcher, and we were talking about podcasting. And then on Wednesday, I was interviewed by Heather Green from Business Week for their Cutting Edge podcast. It was her first interview in a series of interviews that are going to be dealing with the state of the podcasting community industry. Please, if you haven't subscribed to the Business Week podcast series, I think you're going to be interested in this link again in the blog post over at podcast411.com/blog. This interview with Jeff Pulver was done on December 20th. So this was before Jeff Pulver and Andrew Barron from Rocket Boom announced that they were getting into a deal together to form a company called Abbey Studios. So we do not talk about Abbey Studios in this interview, although there is a point in here where Jeff is talking about what he thinks podcasters need, and he mentions about something similar to Federated Media, which based on the blog post over at Dembot, Andrew Barron's blog, he had mentioned the same thing. So what Jeff is talking about there, I'm assuming he's kind of talking about what Abbey Studios is going to offer for podcasters. Again, sorry that we didn't get into specific questions about Abbey Studios, but when this interview was done on December 20th, Abbey Studios was not announced yet. And if you do want to learn more about Abbey Studios, I suggest going over to dembot.com and read Andrew Barron's most recent posts about Abbey Studios. Okay, that all said, I still think today's interview is a good interview. We talk about Network2.tv, we talk a little bit about Pulver Media and the Pulver Media podcast, and we get a couple things in there about poker, a passion of both Jeff and mine. Without further ado, here is my interview with Jeff Pulver from Pulver Media. Jeff, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate your persistence to getting me on the show.
I think the first email I sent was June 15th or June 16th, so it's been a few months.
Yes, it has.
Now, I always start everyone out with this same first question, and that is, what was your first computer?
We didn't really call it a computer, but when I was in third grade, I built a computer that was sort of like a pre-Altark type computer. It was really a binary machine that did that sort of demonstrated the concepts of ones and zeros. That was when I was in third grade, which was a long time ago. And then the first computer in the mid-70s, a friend of mine actually built one of those Altar machines, and I was experiencing at that time with a teletype machine. I was learning, I was hacking into a computer system my father was paying for online service, and I learned BASIC that way, and then Fortran. With a 110-board modem dial-up. So that's sort of when I go back to, is 110-board modem dial-ups.
That was the acoustically coupled modem.
The acoustically coupled type, yes. And, you know, you could always hear the different tones and sounds and stuff. And I used to Well, I really shouldn't tell your listeners this, but we found a way to hack into. I was a hacker when I was in sixth and seventh grade, and we found lovely ways to dial. We certain phone exchanges here on Long Island, which if you dialed, all of a sudden you're in some sort of ordering system, and you were able to get directly into distributors and to hospitals and all sorts of other interesting weird places. And you know, I would have communication with other people sitting behind teletype machines, and that was my first computer experience. Granted, the only thing that was intelligent were the operators on the end of the terminal of the dumb devices. And then, I guess right around that same time, I stumbled into a PDP 11. We had that at my junior high school, junior high school had access to it. And then in my home, my father had arranged with Data General, and I ended up having a Micro Eclipse computer system installed. It was a backup to his office's systems. And right around that same time, plus or minus a year or so, we had the Apple first Apple. Didn't really do much. And then we had the PC, and my father had that. But I ended up getting my first real computer that I still have as a souvenir is a PC-AT. Very super powerful 6 megahertz machine. In the wintertime when we were really cold, I'd fire it up because, you know, with that 32 megs of RAM or and over supercharged, I think we got to 64, and that megs.
32K.
32K. You know, up to maybe 64K, I think we, you know, extended ourselves. That was it.
On the podcasting side, do you remember the first podcast you listened to?
Well, you know, my definition of podcasts and your listener's definition are probably two different things. I still remember hearing Martin Dismar when I downloaded the Progressive Networks player saying that it's been successfully installed, and that was back in 95. And I used to listen to a friend of mine had a company called Tell It, and he had a product called AudioWeb, and he was one of the pioneers who had this great idea that people would want to leave voice messages on web pages and play it back to people. And those were all early days of podcasts, although people didn't realize it at the time. But if I could dial an 800 number and update my sports page and let my listeners on the net hear it, I mean, I have recordings of myself going back to 95. You know, I didn't have any really good auto editing tools back then. Not only could I get rid of the I couldn't get rid of the noise. But I was doing stuff, you know, I felt like I was really sucking. And just because it was just so time-consuming to get something that was great, and I never really thought about the idea of making it, let it be natural, and the idea that maybe sometimes a little background noise is okay, because maybe we don't have to really sound like we're inside of the CBS radio studios. Maybe it's okay for it to be more amateurish, but I was always pushing to be professional. I did have radio experience, because in high school and junior high school, I was semi-active on the radio. Perhaps more than I should have been legally, but it was fun.
I remember on Long Island growing up, there were a few pirate radio stations running around.
Yeah, one was WARG.
Was that yours?
Yes, it was. In fact, the reason PulverRadio.com is on the air since 99, when it started, and it's been live since 2000, it's Pulver Radio, I might add, is commercial-free but not on purpose. It was sort of to make up for my years of being on Long Island trying to be a pirate.
Let's talk a little about... You've had a podcast up with Pulver Media, the PPN podcast. You interview other people, and you have it kind of part of Vonage. Can you explain what that podcast is and what the goal of that podcast was?
When you're pioneering things, you never really do things with a purpose. You kind of just follow what sounds right and feels right. So just to recap a little bit, back in 95, when I was playing with audio on the internet, I didn't realize what we were doing was pod anything. It was more like audio on demand, much like you have video on demand today. And I would do a bunch of shows, which were more than just read-throughs of emails, but it was just sort of iterative, interactive stuff. And then I let it sit for a long time because I got busy with other things. When I built the Pulver Radio Studios in 2000 and it actually became reality, we spent a lot of money building quality just in the infrastructure and stuff. And a few years ago when podcasting all of a sudden had a name and all of a sudden it was the rage, it was fun. Now, in 2000, 2001, I actually did a live radio show called The Pulver Report Live, and it was on Friday afternoons, East Coast time, and it was a blast. And there were times there were only 10 people were tuning in, but it was still fun because it really didn't matter who tuned in. It was the experience of being behind the microphone, having dialed in guests and feeling like we're on the radio now. And some of those interviews were some of the best I ever did at the time. Fast forward a few years, all of a sudden now the word podcasting is out there and this whole idea of audio on demand became a practical reality. So we started interviewing, you know, the interviews we did in the early days of our podcast were interviewing guests on certain salient subjects. The folks who produce the Vaughn conferences, particularly our community developer Carl Ford, he makes it a point to interview a lot of the speakers coming into the conference and in front of the speakers so that those people, so some of our guests who are tuned to podcasts, can get a feel for some of the topics that will be discussed and some of the issues at hand, and also get a way, sort of way, to meet the personality and get to know the people behind the people, sort of at least behind the subjects, since it's hard to get behind yourself. And then you have, you know, some of our vendors get interviewed. And then I used to always use the studios, even now, for topical things, so that if there's a big net neutrality debate or there's a big announcement by somebody, occasionally we would go behind the microphones and record something. This summer I built out the Pulver TV studios, so more likely than not, we probably would go behind the video camera and try to record something and capture the moment and put it out. You know, I try to mix the media wherever possible with the messages, and there's something to be said about having consistent programs out there. Tom Eslin's one of my friends, and we've offered him access to the studio, and he does stuff. John Arnold's out there, and he's doing stuff. And I really leave it to Mikey and to Carl to really set the tone and the pace for the things they're doing and how they do it. And when I do listen to podcasts, it's particularly because I found I do ego surfing on the net. I do go on blog search, and I see that someone's tagged me, and I'm quite curious, what are they saying, or how am I being referenced? And so I go in there. I just think it's an amazing point of time that any of us can go on to an MP. I'm going to Israel in a few hours. The whole idea, though, that I could build a playlist and include in my playlist not only music that I want to listen to, but certain NPR shows I want to listen to, or certain Friends shows I want to listen to. But, you know, in the last few months, I'm really out of touch. You're really catching up on podcasts when they're, you know, at different moments, but it's usually interrupt-driven as opposed to being fans of. What I'm just fascinated by is this explosion, and what's so cool about this is truly, I won't call it citizen journalism, but it's user journalism. Anybody out there can have a radio talk show. Anybody out there can be an expert in anything they want, because as the internet continues to happen, as things continue to be decentralized, everyone is an expert in something. And I think that things like podcasts give lots of opportunities to people who can shine, and they can have the spotlight and they can do it. I mean, I remember in high school, we had to pretend once that we were the DJs at a radio station and develop a radio program. And, you know, no longer do you need to pretend, because anybody with a dream and some connectivity and some software can be a radio host. And it's a beautiful thing. I just really enjoy that. So for me, it's not so much the podcast I want to listen to right now, as opposed to the ability that at any moment in time, I can go up and down the food chain and find people who I do want to hear. The historical archives are there to be found, and that's particularly great for me.
Back in September, you started up a new directory geared towards video on the web, and that's Network 2. Can you explain a little bit what Network 2 is?
Sure. So Network 2, which is network2.tv, is a place which is it's an evolving site. It started out being a place where I was putting content that I was discovering on the internet that I was posing as the polar opposite of YouTube, but more importantly, it was content that was being produced by people who really believed in episodic TV. It just happens to be TV that's seen on the internet, distributed via the net, and put out mostly by people we've never heard of before, but people who certainly are talented, dedicated, and have found that they're calling. And today, network2.tv has 36 different genres listed, so it's sort of long-tail TV. It's a place where people can come in and discover something. They could watch it if they want to. They can also then socialize it with their friends. I have a few days ago, we added a feature called Be a Mini Mogul, where you can come in, build your own network, bring in the stations that you like to listen to or the people you want to see, and then socialize that. And at the beginning, I was calling this the TV Guide for Internet TV content, but it's really grown into be much, much more than that. And at some level, we were acting as a meta directory for people who have content, and it's been a fun ride. The whole thing started out back in June, in fact, right when you were trying to reach me. I was knee-deep in research, trying to figure out the state of video on the internet. In front of the Video on the Net conference I ended up doing in September, I was quite curious how committed were the their traditional networks to building websites for their branded TV channels. And what I had found was that there were about 80 different websites up at the time. Most of them did not have RSS, so how dedicated were these guys to the Web 2.0 world? Not much. And what people really had up was content, but it was very hard to navigate and not all that useful. No. I also found a lot of people trying to be YouTube, about 100 or so type sites like that, and I also found people that were stealing broadcast TV and putting it out, the channel masters of the world, and it was interesting. But and then I just one after the other, I came out with a list of over 80 different shows that were episodic in nature, had a production quality that seemed good, and good enough to actually reference. And so where I ended up going with this is on August 29th, I published a list of about 80-something shows, which I felt were represented shows available only on the internet that are TV-ish, or TV shows only available on the net, as I was calling it. And one of my friends, Jeff Jarvis, immediately saw what I did, and within 24 hours, he basically said, hey, if you take what Jeff just published, take the RSS from it, that equals Network 2.0. And that sort of gave me this idea to repurpose the work of one of the startups that I had been working on since November of 2005. And I took the team and the technology and the platform, and Network 2 TV is, in fact, the repurposed work of one of my startups. And what we ended up with is this platform where you can discover almost anything, see almost anything, and be a place where, you know, people who believe that the future of the internet and the future of TV has RSS in it, you can sort of live in the future right now. And that's where it started from. And, you know, we've gotten to know a lot of the indie producers, a lot of the people responsible for creating great content on a shoestring budget, but people who are not beholden to the Hollywood studios, not beholden to the networks for distribution. They got the internet. They're not beholden to anything or anyone for there's no gatekeeper. It's really just them, their vision, and their ability to execute. And it's a pretty great medium to be playing in right now.
A lot of my listeners are the content creators. One question I have when I look at Network2.tv is, how do you submit content to be included on Network 2?
Well, there should be somewhere a link that says suggest a show. That was the first step of it. We're adding a page for the executive producers to fill out a profile and basically directly opt in to have their content listed and to tell us what shows they want to have associated with us. Today, I've been the recipient of more emails. The inbound side has been basically emails to jeff@pulver.com combined with people who are submitting shows directly, and that usually is how it goes.
You also do conversations with Jeff Pulver, and you've interviewed Dave Weiner and a few other people. For you, on your side, who would you really like to have in the chair? Who would you really like to interview?
Mark Cuban. Mark was one of the first speakers at our Vaughn conference back in April '97. You know, Ted Leonsis. Ted actually, you know, he spoke at Fall Vaughn. I added him to my game today, and he actually responded.
But yeah, Ted is very progressive, and for people that don't know him, Ted, I think he's vice chairman at AOL. And
vice chairman, yes.
Yeah, and he's the owner of the Washington Capitals. You know, the Washington Capitals have been doing a podcast, one of the best podcasts in the NHL since there has been podcasting, and they were doing it as streaming audio before that. I want to talk about a passion that we both share, and that is poker. And
yes.
I know you went out on the first day of the World Series main event this year.
I did make it to the second day last year, but yeah.
What busted you out this year?
John Benetti making me believe that I should play conservative. yeah, I know. What busted me out was I was 8 hours into the game, and I had basically treaded water, so I had no more chips than I had really when I started. And I just had this strong feeling I was going to win. I had a pair of queens. And I went all in, mostly because there were two bracelet winners at the table. A guy that won from Australia that won in 2006, and someone who won in 2005. And they had just played a hand 5 minutes before that one, where one guy was betting big against the other. And it turned out the high card someone had was a six.
Oh, God. So you're looking at a queens, and you're thinking, hey, that's a great hand.
Hey, right. And so I went all in, which would have shown that I had aces, right? Crazy, but I would have had aces. This guy, one of the pro in the far end of the corner, basically called me immediately. And then before the flop, I said, oh, my God, I lost. He showed kings, though. So either he put me in for aces and didn't care, or he figured I didn't have better than kings. And, of course, on the flop, another king came up, so I was just dead. Because, that was not good. So I busted out. But my friend's mentor, Phil's mentor, John Benetti, who just got out of the hospital, even though he was really sick for a while, and he He was in the hospital since October 8th and he just got out. He was saying to me, Jeff, it's, you know, remember two things. It's P&P. I said, what? It's, you know, patience and position. Patience and position. Patience and position. For 8 hours long, I'm like sitting there and I'm playing very tight.
Now, are you going to play again in the main event this year? Or
yep. 2007? In 2007, yeah.
Yeah. I actually had Phil Gordon on the show in the past and it was fun to talk with.
Yeah, Phil's fun though, because, you know, I'm friends with Helmuth, but Gordon, like, I had a situation, played in Shooting Stars a year ago, and I asked both Phil Gordon and Phil Helmuth how to play a certain hand, and the long and the short of it was that the last time around the table, this is like 5 hours into this game, there was absolutely no action whatsoever going down, and I basically was tired, but that's not an excuse. Anyway, I was the first one up after the big blind. I had a pair of queens again. These queens kill me, you know? So, but this particular time, I decided to slow play, because I had actually, right before that, I had a pair, I think, of kings or aces, and no one went in. When I was the big blind, I had a pair of aces, and everybody folded. Which really bothered me, you know? So, I have a pair of queens. I decided to slow play the queens. Everyone folds except the big blind, who basically checked in, right? The flop comes up 3-7 jack. I'm sitting there, I bet. The big blind raises me. I'm saying, okay, what does he have, a 3 or 7 or a jack? I got a pair of queens. I re-raise, we both go all in, right? And he shows that what he had was a 3 and a 7.
Oh.
So
I hate losing to rags.
Right. So Phil Gordon says, schmuck, you know, if you're going to go in the game, you have to raise to make sure the big blind doesn't just, you know, doesn't just limp in. He says, you deserve to lose. And then Phil Helmuth says, Jeff, I would have played it just that same way. You know, those are called bad beats. Get over it.
Yeah. Oh, like Phil gets over bad beats. Yeah. There's someone who takes his own advice.
There you go.
I love Phil's comment. If it wasn't for luck, he goes, I'd win every hand.
Exactly right. At the World Series, you know, he lost out. He had ace-queen. Oh, I think it was. I saw him fall out. It's funny. I was actually sitting right there, and it took him 15 minutes to remember who I was. But he says, Jeff, what are you doing? When did you get here? I said, I've been here the whole time.
So we'll get back here into another thing that we both care about, and you've mentioned and talked a little bit about, which was what got me interested to contact you originally, and that is net neutrality.
Right.
And with the changing in Congress, do you think that getting Senator Ted out of his position, do you think that's going to help net neutrality going down the line, or do you think the way it was blocked in last Congress is pretty much, it's going to take literally an act of Congress to get things reversed?
I think it's going to take an act of Congress to... the problem also with net neutrality these days is that I can't tell you whose side I'm on anymore due to all the politicking that's going on. It's really clouded the situation, and my own beliefs have been affected by it. So the wrong people are empowered. There's not a chance. We don't have a chance to really be in control of the future, and that would be really bad. For me, what I want to make sure, in some ways, I'm trying to preserve the academic internet that we're all used to. It's not that I don't respect the fact that the phone companies think that things should be a certain way, and the cable companies think they should be a certain way, and internet companies think they should be a certain way, because the very big companies, it's agnostic to them. It doesn't matter. They can afford to pay whatever extortion they're being charged. It's just everybody else I'm worried about. And I'm worried about doing things that disrupt the industrial revolution that we've all been benefiting from for the past 11 years, whether we recognize it or not. And that's really what's at stake. It's just the future of our economic future and our kids. You know, I want to make sure that even if when people think they're in power, how much power do they really have? And, you know, be careful what you wish for, because sometimes it comes true.
My biggest argument against, I guess, or a problem with the argument from the cable companies and the telcos is, we paid for all this, we built all this network out, it's ours, we can do what we want with it.
Except for companies like Google, I don't know, and Amazon and eBay and places like that, you know, they're the ones who are actually creating the value. It's like, you know, I'm sorry, but I would not be signing on to Yahoo and Google in a hotspot if it wasn't because I wouldn't want to look up someone's information.
Well, I would take this example. We had Everest running cables in the community where we live. Who do you think gave Everest the right of ways? The government. These cable companies and telcos get a lot handed to them from the taxpayers in the way of right-of-ways. If they had to negotiate with every property owner and pay to put the cables in, that would be a big difference. So they get a lot of handouts. Plus, they also get tax breaks for building out the infrastructure. That's my biggest argument with their argument, is that, no, it's not just their network. It really is a public domain network. And if they tier it, and that's what they really want to do, is they do want to tier it, then it will hurt the little guy.
Little guy may actually fail to exist, but I don't think that's a real viable option in America. But don't push your luck is my problem, because you never know what could happen.
You've got Podshow out there, you've got Kiptronix, Libsyn, Podtrac, Radiotail, all these different ad networks that are coming up. What do these guys need to do then to make podcasting a viable economic community?
They need to be much better equipped to deal with the media companies of today. They need to be able to go into any shop on Madison Avenue and sell them.
Podshow's been trying to do that for a year so far. And I guess they have some success. They have some advertising, but...
But Podshow has big money behind them. So yeah. Look about everybody else.
$24.5 million, yeah. That's insignificant numbers, no.
I think the trouble is that, we always point to a brand within everyone else, and I have to worry about everybody else, because I assume the big boys either get funded or go out of business, but what about everyone else who's trying to struggle, who have background passions in this and trying to make the transition from enthusiast and hobbyist to impassionate one to try to make a living from it? And that's really when I want to embrace those folks. If you could find a way to create your own federated media platform where you brought together and people trusted this platform where they're all united, so that you now represent, not one podcast, not even 100, but 10,000. And these are all people that really believe in what they do. It'd be a much different place out there.
Okay, I would say Libsyn is close to that at this point, because they have so many podcasters on their network.
No, but we don't know how many listeners they have.
I think they had 13 million unique IP downloads in September, was the last stats I heard.
Well, we know, again, that's downloads. We don't know listeners.
Right, and that's another issue. There's
we have an issue about eardrums.
Then people, I know the counter argument as well, downloads are a lot more reliable than someone filling out a survey in a logbook, like Arbitron. So I know that's the big issue. That there's still not, if you're a buyer and you're at Toyota, or you're one of the car companies, that spends $16 billion a year in advertising, podcasting is perfect for you, but you still can't justify it to your boss why you spent the money you spent and how the ROI is measured.
Right.
And I think, that comes back to the metrics. How do we get over that hump? You've gotten involved. You've brought Chris Brogan on board, and Chris is one of the founders of PodCamp. So you went to PodCamp. What was your feeling?
As far as PodCamp goes, what really got me was, a few things got me. First of all, it turned out that a lot of the people who I was having attend as my guests at Video on the Net were actually part of the ecosystem at PodCamp, which was wow. When I first went there, I got there too late on Saturday to attend the session, so I found out where they were hanging out, and I opened the bar for people, because it's sometimes a nice way to meet people by getting them a little comfort.
You think?
it goes a long way sometimes. I did that. I really didn't meet too many people, but I met a few, and that was really cool. And the next day I got there, and Chris meets me briefly and says, hey, you gonna be here for a few minutes? I said, sure. And literally within 15 minutes later, I was scheduled to do a session. And he updated the wiki. He updated the wiki. 15 minutes later, people show up. 11 people show up in the session that had just been added. I was blown away, because it gave me a great opportunity to try out some of the material that I used in my keynote speech the next day or 2 days later. And the people were just so nice and receptive and open and sharing. And I realized this is great. And I sort of knew when I met Chris, I realized he was a star. So I kind of asked him if he'd want to join our team, and he did. So I'm really happy to say that Chris Brogan is part of what we all do, and he too is a community developer, and boy, does he know how to develop those communities.
Yeah, Chris is a good guy. I met him at PodCamp Pittsburgh. I went there.
He said that. He said that.
And I'm Michael Bailey, who you've communicated with. Me and Michael are running the Kansas City PodCamp.
Good for you too.
And Michael is a really good programmer. You should hire him. You should buy his company. That guy has got so many good ideas. I'll tell you what, the best engineering programmer I ever met.
There's no doubt he has some great stuff. I was really blown away by the widgets that are on Chris's page promoting him. One of the tech trends of 2006 that no one ever really wrote about was the fact that, as far as I could tell, if it's a tech event, particularly a networking event, the geeks show up early.
Well, Michael Arrington's been pretty good about throwing some tech events.
You know, I've been doing this for 10 years, and my only word of advice to Mike is, if you're doing a tech event, you might not want to have the background music be in the foreground. And you might want to have the lights up so people can see each other. It's just, you know, maybe that's a California thing, I don't know. But for me personally, I'd rather see the people face-to-face than deal with them otherwise. Okay. But, yeah, I went to this tech party in New York City, and it was a hoot. Great, great people, and certainly a very strong buzz.
On your latest blog post, you're talking about blog tag. Can you explain what blog tag is?
Yes, in my own words. Here's what happened. 2 weeks ago, today actually, I'm at a cocktail party for a fundraiser. I'm in Manhattan at an art gallery, and I'm talking to some people who I know, and out of the blue, this film student comes up to me, starts a conversation. He knows what I look like, as it turns out, because he saw my blog, and he had relevant topics to talk about because he read my blog, and in fact, he knew more about me than my family because he read my blog. And
we call that stalkers in the offline world.
Stalkers, okay. Yeah. Well, he like made it a point, although I didn't say I was going to be at this gallery, but it was just coincidental that we were both supporting the same charity, and there he is, and he speaks for like almost a half hour, and it was pretty okay. It was idle chit chat, but nonetheless, it was good stuff, and I give the guy a lot of credit for like knowing me. And you know, that weekend I come home and I'm like thinking about this stuff, and I'm realizing, gee, he thinks he knows me because he reads my blog. Someone may think they know you because they listen to your podcast, and it's like, okay, but how well do we know any of these people? In fact, you know, aren't all these people that we know from afar, even those that we know a little bit, aren't they really like underdeveloped characters in a novel? And wouldn't it be great if there'd be a way that we could find out a little bit more about the people who we look up to or the people that we think we know, just to better understand this? And so I came up with this concept. I called it a virtual cocktail party, where, you know, you say something about yourself and you then get others to share that information. And I was inspired because right around Thanksgiving, I remember stumbling across people playing tag or doing something, and I couldn't really find any consistency. Some people were saying 7 things about themselves. Sometimes it was 6 things I hate about you. And it was like, you know, this is silly stuff. And it's like, I'm not into hate. I'm more into love than hate. And certainly I was really more into just sharing information, because I really think the internet's a social sculpture. And I think the blogosphere, many people forget about the fact that it is a place you can get to know a lot of information. And while somebody might have a blog just talking about health, and someone may have a blog that's talking about high tech, at the end of the day, there are people who are behind the blogs, and there are people who make these blogs tick every day or every month, every week, and it's like, why not get to know them? So I posted this idea of blog tag, and I tagged 5 people. I tagged 2 people in the VoIP industry. I tagged a couple of people in the video side, and I tagged a friend of mine in Israel who's a venture capitalist. And over time, I mean, in one day, I saw 4 and 5 generations. Less than a week goes on, I saw 11 generations of it go through. A couple of days into it, a guy from South Africa who happens to be in the VoIP industry started his own rogue chain. And 10 days later, well over hundreds, almost hundreds, but not quite, of people have joined in and started playing. And what I realized was, you know, what if I wanted to play tag, but no one ever came over to tag me? So today I decided, you know, why not encourage this for anyone to play it? It's like, don't wait to be tagged. If you haven't been tagged yet, but you want to play it with your friends, do so. I went in and I basically used the opportunity to say 5 more things about myself that most people don't know. And I encouraged people to play. And one of the people who I tagged was Ted Leonsis. And he actually played today. And he actually said some interesting things about himself. So it was pretty cool. And it's always like, you always surprised, like, oh my God, wow, like these people actually are playing. And in fact, on the first day, what was really cute was Mike Arrington came in and he said he wanted to be tagged, but he wanted to play, but he wasn't tagged. So I made it a point today to tag him. So I think that the social tag stuff here is the blog tag is just a reminder of how the internet is a social sculpture, and every once in a while it's nice to know the people who are behind the words, and behind the voices, and behind the camera lenses.
Well, you know, we are Time's Person of the Year, right?
We're all it. Congratulations.
Yes.
Thanks for you following up. I have to pack and. Okay. Go on this family trip. It's been great, and thanks for your time, and I look forward to catching up in person.
Okay, happy holidays, and have a safe trip.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that concludes our interview with Jeff Pulver from Pulver Media and Network2.tv and now Abbey Studios. If you want to learn more about Jeff Pulver, go to pulver.com or you can go into the show notes and I'll have a link there over to his blog. As always, if you have any feedback you'd like to share with the show, you can give us a call at 206-666-4357 or you can go to podcast411.com and click on the My Chingo button. And finally, you can send audio feedback to podcast411@gmail.com. And speaking of feedback, I really want to thank everybody that sent in their condolences on the passing of my father-in-law. Those messages from you were greatly appreciated and definitely helped lift some spirits. And speaking of that, I'm going to end today's show with one of those messages. This is Rob from Podcast 411 reminding you to listen different.
Hey, Rob, this is Mark Kelso. I'm not trying to get on your podcast. I just wanted to leave you another comment. You know, I met you at the podcast expo, and I thank you for signing your book that I was able to purchase there. I just wanted to share something, maybe the best compliment ever that you can get from a listener, and it's a simple one. You know, when I put my iTunes together and I get the favorite ones out there, and I go for my walk or whatever, as soon as I see Podcast 411, I stop what I'm listening, and yours is right there on the list. And there's a few favorites, but yours is mine. And I just want to say thanks for sharing a lot of your time. Thanks for keeping it clean. Thanks for all the guests, and my heart goes out for you this holiday time with the loss of your father-in-law. It's you're absolutely correct. Family is everything, and in a weird way, the podcast, at least the early podcasters and listeners, you can kind of think that they were family or our family. So, all the best to you this new 2007, and you're great. Thank you again for everything.